Hi, this is Steve Porcaro, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. Only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the release of his first new studio album in 9 years called The Very Day, please welcome Grammy-winning keyboardist and founding member of the band Toto, Mr. Steve Porcaro. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing good. Steve, I'm currently in rainy North Carolina. Where are you right now?
I'm in sunny Southern California.
Damn
it. Believe me, I'm honestly jealous of you. I love it when it rains.
Well, I lived in Los Angeles for 30 years. My wife and I just relocated here this past January. And it is kind of cool. The seasons are kind of cool. It's. I'm not saying that the LA weather is not perfect, but it is neat to see the seasons. So
absolutely.
That's where we're at. Steve, born and raised in Southern California.
No, I was born in Connecticut. Born in Hartford, Connecticut. We moved to LA like when I was just turning 9. We moved in August of 66. I turned 9 September 2nd. So for the most part, LA.
So how big of a factor do you think living in Los Angeles played in you deciding to pursue a career in music?
It was huge because, you know, initially, I mean, everyone of my brothers and myself and all my friends who are around my age, like a lot of people, it was the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show was ground zero for us. I never was into Elvis or Buddy Holly or any other rock and roll pre the Beatles. Part of that was my age. Around my house was all, you know, was Miles Davis. My dad was a jazzer and some classical music, but really our heroes were guys who were making a living doing music especially in LA, that meant studio musicians. Those were always our heroes, our realistic heroes as far as what we aspired to, which is what my dad was doing, which was making a living doing music in the studio. You know, he was never aspired to be a rock star. Maybe a bebop drummer in playing with Miles Davis or something like that. But it was the studio musicians, the Leon Russells, then Don Randy, Jim Keltner, Jim Gordon, Hal Blaine, you know, what they call the Wrecking Crew now. Right. Later, some other guys. Those were our heroes. Those were the guys. That's what we aspired to do. And being that my dad did it, and would let us go to sessions with him and we'd see these guys there, you know, it always felt possible. You know what I mean? Like within reach. It wasn't just this, I want to be a rock star and I'm living in the, you know what I mean? I'm living so far away from it. We were right there in LA where all this was going on every day. And it seemed attainable, you know?
Absolutely. If you're a kid from middle America, it might seem difficult, but if you're growing up in it, you're like, oh yeah, we can do this. All these guys do it. So can we.
Yeah. But it wasn't until we moved to LA and where all of a sudden there was this huge, I was just turning 9 and, I learned later on what an age that is, what an awakening that is, that realization that maybe there is no Santa Claus and just the reality of the world. And, it was a huge culture shock going from Connecticut to all of a sudden LA and just our surroundings. It hit me like a ton of bricks and it was very exciting, you know.
And at what age specifically do you think you knew this is what I want to do?
Pretty early on, you know what I mean? Being that my dad always did it, I just, everyone had a lot of doubt, especially about me. I mean, my brother Jeff, everyone had no doubt that he would do well because, I mean, in kindergarten, he was playing, you know what I mean? He was turning heads then. Me, I was a horrible, horrible piano student. You know, my dad was trying to prepare me. You know, if he saw I was leaning towards, you know, I loved playing piano, but he was hooking me up with teachers that were trying to make me employable, which was either sight reading, so you could do studio work, which I was horrible at, or you know, learning the Great American Songbook, so you could accompany singers. All the things you are in the key of E flat, and you could play an introduction, and you know what I mean? Or play in a hotel lobby, for God's sakes, play standards, just be employable was the goal. And I just completely lucked out. And, you know, the timing of when I got, when I was in high school and I saw my brother Jeff had right out of the gate and left high school early to go on the road with Sonny and Cher, and my brother Mike, pretty much the same thing. You know, right out of the gate was doing well. And I was like coming up into my 12th year. And I was like, you know, looking at the guys that they were doing sessions with and the keyboard players, I was not going to replace Michael or David Page or David Foster or Don Randy or whoever else you want to name. I was nowhere near that level of, facility on keyboards. But I did see this. I did have this really early interest in synthesizers, and I did see this huge chasm between the guys that knew synths and those guys I just mentioned, you know, because most of the general rule was the better of a piano player you were, the less you knew about synths or wanted to bother with that stuff. And, whereas the guys who really knew about it were kind of these nerdy pocket protector wearing guys that you weren't going to hire for your session. You know what I'm saying? And I came right at this time where guys like David Foster and David Page and stuff, they just started telling producers they wanted to have me around. They wanted to hire me along with them whenever they were doing synthesizers because I was handy to be around. I could keep them in tune. And I'm the guy who had that weird black box that could make where you could play a Moog from an ARP and vice versa, where in those days it was very difficult to, it wasn't just one chord from one synth to another like it is now, you know, now that we have MIDI. It was a very different situation then. And I totally got in there and started getting hired to do synthesizer stuff on my own.
Very cool. When your brothers are leaving high school early, were your parents okay with that? Or were you encouraged to stay till you graduated? How did that work?
Well, they were absolutely okay with it, especially Jeff. Jeff was just this undeniable talent and he just was on fire from a very early age. Again, I think my parents had wished I had had more education, especially later on. I had no idea I would have a chance of ever doing film work. And there's a big part of me that wishes I had a 4-year college musical education. You know what I mean?
It's not too late, Steve.
Right?
you could still go back.
It's true. It's true. No, you know what? But like I said, that whole synthesizer thing, I kind of really got into it and embraced it and made it my own. And the way I combined musicality with the technical side of things kind of became my thing. And I just kind of lucked into that. And I also left school early because I got a gig on the road with Gary Wright at 17. And I'll put it to you this way. I didn't ask my parents' permission.
Is a 17-year-old ready to go on the road with Gary Wright?
Hell no. absolutely not. But it was, you know, I was joining the circus. I was running away to the circus. And thank God I had a guy like Gary who was a total sweetheart who totally took me under his wing. Him and his road manager at the time were very protective of me. And that's not to say I didn't get into some trouble, but but at least they were great. And Boss Skaggs was great to work for. These were guys that were just wonderful people, wonderful human beings to work for and work with.
I feel like they were legends even back then.
Yeah.
Already. Steve, are you a father?
I am.
If your kids wanted to leave school at 17 and join the circus, how would that have gone?
You know, not very well. You know what I mean? Not very well. I just wanted them to be on fire about something.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If it was music, fine. I just want them to this day, want them to find their what they're on fire about, you know?
I agree.
I'm very lucky to have been able to parlay it into a living, you know?
Yeah. An amazing career. And before we talk about the very day, since you brought Jeff up a couple times, I want to go back to a track from your last studio album from 2016 called Someday Somehow. The track is called Back to You. Features a drum track by Jeff.
Stop. Think of it. This time I'm talking about sooner than later. You plug into it. Maybe then we can walk the equator. She knows her place. Having weathered the storm taking years. Runs the race through the past with the laughs and the tears. I can do my best to hide this deep inside. And I say they're lying, knowing that it's true. Promise me that when I see you, you'll be mine. Needing someone to hold me back. Turn back to you.
I was wondering, did you find that track and then build a song around it? Is that what you did?
Yeah, it was actually an old Toto track. Okay. And I had, you know, I don't have access to the Toto masters. Those I don't have access to those masters, but we made a lot of secondary tapes. You know what I mean? It's not politically correct now. We called them slave tapes at the times, as opposed to the masters. And they had cut a song of mine, Back to You, and no one was very ever interested in putting it out. And I had this tape in my locker, and you know, Paige and I had our own locker where we kept a lot of our work tapes and our own personal stuff that we'd worked on. And when I was putting the album together, it was just like, you know, you want these things to see the light of day. You know what I mean? And it was something right. I'd done a long time ago. And it was something that both my brothers, now I didn't ask anyone's permission as far as the band or my brother's estates, if it was okay if I use this and put them out. I just did it. I'm kind of, I'm that way. I'll dive into stuff and deal with the details later sometimes when it comes to my music, but it was all my song.
Well, it's a great song. So I'm glad you did it. And I'm glad it's out there. And I'm glad people can
thanks. Hear it, thanks. There's aspects of it that haven't aged well. But I just want to get it out there.
Sure. Okay. So The Very Day, it's out right now for digital purchase and streaming. Will there be physical copies available?
Absolutely. I insisted on it. Unfortunately, probably won't be to the first of the year. They're getting the packaging together right now. This my record company, they've been incredibly supportive, but they're I think they're used to mostly just doing digital releases these days, and they wanted to see what, if any, the demand was. And they found out, especially a guy my age, and you know, old Toto fans love physical product, and
for sure. And vinyl is such a big deal now. I mean, how can you not do it?
It's huge. And I put a lot into my artwork and stuff too. I believe me, the whole, I'm pleased that a lot of people are noticing the running order, the way songs the way the songs flow from one to another, like we used to care about so much, you know. Yeah,
exactly.
Relationships, stuff like that. I crossfade a couple songs from one to the other. I definitely was keep thinking like an album, you know what I mean? That would have a big gatefold you could open up and roll a joint on, you know?
And now you got to figure out which track is going to end side one for when we flip it over. You got to take that into consideration. And how are you going to start side two with a bang and end with a bang, all that stuff.
Yep. Yep. And they had to, they were with my album, the way I had it, the order I had things, it wasn't going to fit on one disc. So we did have to make a few minor adjustments to the running order for the vinyl.
All right. So The Very Day, produced by Steve Porcaro. Is that guy easy to work with?
Not at all. No, I run at my own pace. Just the whole thing here was just me having my own way. Believe me, I play well with others. I was in a band for a long time. I know how to compromise. I did a lot of film work. Working with producers, sometimes getting conflicting input and dealing with it. And it was so nice that all of these songs, it was just about me as a writer and me finishing these things. I would just, if I was stuck at all, I'd bring in someone to help me finish it. But there was kind of an agreement with all my collaborators that these were my babies. I started these songs and I kind of had the final say. I was always open to trying anything. That's the great thing about one plus side to the technology these days is that there was never, I would always, if anyone had something to try that I didn't agree with, I still would give it a go. I love being pleasantly surprised. I love going, whoa, I didn't think that would work in a million years. And I love it. I love when that happens. So, I would always with my collaborators, you know, would try a different way of doing things. But at the end of the day, I had final say and, cause it was my project and I'm the artist on it. And, I knew I was being really, really indulgent, but people seem to be responding, you know?
Well, I think you've earned the right to be like this. I mean, sure. After the illustrious career you've had, I mean,
can I tell everyone you said so?
Absolutely. Yeah. Put it on the back of the album. The title of the album comes from a lyric in the song Water from the Sky.
Yes.
What made you decide to choose these three words specifically as the album title?
I was about a month away from being done. I was my girlfriend Heather Hart. Her son was over. He was actually borrowing my studio, and when he came in, I was working on Water from the Sky. And I'm very. He's like from a very different generation, and. Water from the Sky is such my nod to Yes and my self letting myself be very self-indulgent and just going for it, doing, you know what I mean, reminding myself that I can do whatever the hell I want to do, and it's eight and a half minutes long, and anyway, the song was going by and he was loving it, and And he heard the vocal. And when that lyric went by, he goes, there's your album title right there. And I said, you know what? You're right.
That's cool. You know what I mean? I love those three words as an album title, because you can decide what that means to you.
I would have never come up with that as the album title in a million years. He just spouted that, you know, said, there's your album title the very day. And I was like, good one.
Yeah, perfect. Now, were all these songs written specifically for this album, or were you choosing from a back catalog of previously written tunes?
Very much so a back. These were all over the place. I've been over the years such a pack rat as far as my musical ideas go. Several were written from start to finish, within the last couple of years. You know, there were, you know, newer songs, but there's a couple in particular that were very old, that were very old ideas, that were very old just sections. One was a B section, one was a chorus, and this was the thing now, is that I didn't want even my own limitations to stop me from getting these things out. So if I was stuck and couldn't figure out a verse that led into that B section or chorus or whatever, I picked up the phone and called friends, asked them if they wanted to help me with a tune I'm working on, and would send them the part I had and say, are you interested? And they usually said yes and helped me finish these things. And now I get to these things I've been carrying along, a couple of them, I'm not kidding, for decades.
Wow.
You know, I just, you know, sure, a lot of the old motifs don't age well, but some of them just do. Some of them I'll listen to them and I'll go, that's a strong chorus. I don't care what anyone says. And I want to finish it, you know?
So the first track on the album is called Maryland, co-written with Stan Lynch of The Speaker Wars and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Torn between the two things you want the most, hard to have it all. Wasn't sure, but now we're not even close to what's real, so I'm gone. You gave a taste, now I'm falling down. My walls are breaking, the room is closing in.
Is he one of those guys that you gave a call to help finish this?
Yes. And Maryland was a song that was pretty much written very recently, just less than a couple of years ago. I had it done for the most part. I just brought in Stan because overall I'm trying to just up my lyric game.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Sometimes I get lucky. Sometimes it's just kind of I get tired of my word salad and want to try have something, have a little more meaning, have some kind of possible narrative or something that people can follow, where it's not just words that kind of sound good and go together.
Well, as soon as the album was sent to me and I saw the first song was called Maryland, it just made me think that the guys from Toto, you guys love to write songs with a one-word female song title. We got Angela, Lorraine, Rosanna, Carmen, Hollyanna, Leah, Pamela, Anna, Melanie, and here's Marilyn.
Well, who, you know, doesn't, sure. No, there's, I mean, look at what, women haven't inspired other songwriters. There's lots of women's names out there for songs. And I don't know, you know, none of us was ever the, you know, the one thing Toto was always missing was we never had our tortured artist who carried around his journal and was our lyricist. You know what I mean? We always just kind of, we're musos who kind of did it themselves. You know, we all were such huge fans of was it Terry Reid and Procol Harum and you know, guys like you know, Bernie Taupin and stuff. You know, we're always jealous of Elton starting off a song with amazing lyrics. You know, usually lyrics were usually the last thing we would think about. I wish we spent as much time on our lyrics as we did on our bass drum sounds and or even on synthesizer sounds. I wish we spent as much time on our lyrics and because especially, you know what I mean? You know, songs, you know, the better the lyrics, the better they age. And the more people you seem to hit when they're when they actually mean something. And, you know, so yeah,
I mean, every music listener isn't a musician. So like for me, I love lyrics because I can sing along. I can interpret them the way I want to, or maybe it's just
sure.
plain and simple. The message is right there. So yeah, I'm a lyric person. And yeah, you're hitting it out of the park on this album. It just flows and it is just fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, lyrically, if I could just add, just say, when I was a kid, you know, we were such musos.
Yeah.
We're so about being proficient at our instrument and, you know, being studio musicians and stuff, of course. And I remember as a young kid, if I heard Bob Dylan on the radio, I couldn't change the channel fast enough. You know what I mean? You know, it was just, you know, that's the level of I don't know. It just was a bad singer to me. Then yeah. Flash to like the, I think it was the first year we were here into the second year where you're here. My brother, my oldest brother's obsessed with this album, Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix. And my favorite song by far on the album. I love the whole album, but here's the song All Along the Watchtower. And I'm hearing this not only, you know, great record, but great song also. And I'm going, these are the best damn lyrics I've ever heard. How cool are these lyrics? And you look at the album credits and, huh, maybe there's something I'm missing there. You know what I mean?
That happens. Yeah.
Very much an eye-opening thing. Like, you know what? I need to not be judging this guy next to, you know, Steve Perry. You know what
I mean? Yeah, true.
Or fill in the spaces. It's like, you know, but check out what's going on lyrically there.
So I'm currently reading a book about the band The Cars.
Cool.
And in the book, it talks about 1978 Best New Artist Grammy nominees are The Cars, Toto, Elvis Costello, Chris Rea, and Taste of Honey. And
was Chris Rea, wasn't the Eurythmics in there or something?
I looked it up today, so I'm right. But they thought they might win. But they never thought Taste of Honey was going to win. Who did you think was going to win that night?
Anybody but Taste of Honey. You know what I mean? All of those, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of a huge embarrassment.
I mean,
for the Grammy. You know, but you know what it did do is that when we did win in 83, I don't know about the other guys. I can't speak for the other guys, but because our first year, and there's The Cars, and I thought those guys were the coolest, and they were all dressed cool, and I love their record. And, you know, there's Elvis Costello. There's all these great artists, you know, Taste of Honey. You know what I mean? I don't want to speak out. Right.
Yes. It's just like, but when you look at the legacy of the names that were up that year,
crazy,
they missed the mark.
Right?
Yeah, they missed
what
the mark.
What that did for me was put the Grammys in perspective. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So that when we did win, believe me, and we had a good night, and we worked really, really hard on that record, and we were proud of our work. But like when we won Producer of the Year, and we had to walk by, you know, we had to walk by Gary Katz, who was a hero of us, and Quincy and Foster and stuff. That was like, okay, we've won. You know what I mean? It's time to spread the love. But you know what I mean? It just was our night that night. But
it really was. And
it didn't make me, you know what I mean? I got over myself real quick that night because of that first year in 70.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we can look back and there's tons of missteps by the Grammys. Of course.
Oh, Steve, they would call Toto winning that year a huge misstep. Believe me, you know.
Well, it's not. And we're talking about Toto 4. And a song on that album that you sing and wrote is It's a Feeling, which is a great track. I want to know, why didn't you sing more in Toto? I mean, I know everyone could sing, but
yep.
I feel like you could have sang a little bit more. Were you advocating to sing, or were you okay not to?
I was totally okay not to. Really, it was what I wanted to do was write more. And when I did write, like on the very first album, the guys loved my song, Taking It Back, on the very first album. And And I didn't really see any of the other guys singing it. I would have loved it if our lead singer could sing my songs.
Yeah.
I would have been fine never, ever singing. But I just didn't hear like the kick-ass singer thing or somebody with a lot of vibrato. I just wanted to hear someone who sang like me. And we eventually wound up with a guy, Joseph Williams. I had just, Joseph Williams wound up in the band and he sang my stuff perfectly. As a matter of fact, there's a song Leah on the Fahrenheit album.
Here's to the you who saved my love. Only to you I gave my love. I give any thought, and it's not all that appears.
And I had just done a vocal on it, painstakingly again. it was torture for me to do vocals. Torture, okay? Especially not having the tools we have now,
right?
To help out. It just was not fun whatsoever on any level for me to get a finished vocal. And the guys were such perfectionists, and I love the way it sounds. When I hear Taking It Back or It's a Feeling, I love the result of it, but the actual doing it, and I could never do it live. I'd never be able to sing my songs live. So when we had a singer in Joseph Williams that could do my stuff live,
yeah,
I loved it. But and it was more about that I didn't write more, and I didn't write more because I was so I was constantly aware that my gig in the band was being the synth guy.
Was being the synth guy,
and especially in those early days, it was hard. I wasn't I didn't know anything about electronics and stuff. I made friends with a lot of these guys who did. You know, that was my talent, was hanging out with the smart guys. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I made friends with all those guys and was into the arranging aspect of it and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Let's jump back into the very day. Track 3, Change, lead vocals by Michael McDonald. I read that this song was originally written for you to present to Michael Jackson. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. I'd written 3 songs, and my partner, my songwriting partner, Michael Sherwood, came over one day and he goes, and they were all kind of funky things. They were all things that he thought all 3 of them. He did a vocal pass on all 3 of them, just kind of scatting, thinking we got to pitch these to Michael and to Michael Jackson. And of course, I always thought there was all the time in the world to do that.
Yeah, sure.
I was still working. I worked on every single Michael Jackson solo album except his very last one, Invincible. I'd worked on all the rest, so you know, I was always part of the team and in the camp, and thought there was all the time in the world to present that stuff to him. But when he shockingly passed in 2010. I realized I wanted this thing to be heard. You know, I thought it was a real strong song, and that Michael, and then Michael even brought in Julius Robinson to help with the lyrics. And I thought it was real strong and needed to be, it's another one of those things that's, you just want to get out there for people to hear it.
And you found this new guy, Michael McDonald, and he seems pretty good.
Yeah, you know, I've gone to the well there a few times. Michael sang 2 songs on my previous album for me.
Yes, I want to mention Night of Our Own, which to me from the last album sounds like that should have been a hit. I mean, to my ears, that's just killer.
Another night and I'm safe in the light of a love. Then you arrive just as sure as the clock on the wall. So many things to share about the day, but you say if it's all the same, let's take a minute now and all of our friends have gone home. What good's a candlelight when both ends are burning so low? Don't need a miracle, we just need a night of our own.
Thanks. That was completely an independent release, and we all know, you know what I mean, what that's code for. You know what I'm saying? Promotion and getting it out there and stuff. I'm hoping to God somebody, you know what I mean? Some music supervisor, somebody who, you know what I mean? There's some romantic comedy or romantic movie that someone discovers that and puts it in their movie. Believe me, that's kind of my intentions now. I'm retired from touring and doing film work or whatever, but I would love for these things to see the light of day. So I love that you feel that way about it. You know?
Yeah, I really do. You mentioned, you know, with presenting a song to Michael, you always thought there'd be more time. And with the passing of Mike and Jeff, how does that make you change how you live your life as you get older? And you know, and because we don't know what'll happen. I'm 61 and, you know.
I'll tell you, it's perfected me profoundly, profoundly. It's why I quit touring. It's why I stopped doing film work. And my ethos on this album, it really was very, very different. It was that I just was like, I would catch myself like trying to get a horn sound up, trying to synthesize a horn sound, which is something people used to hire me to do. I was really good at it, if I do say so. But I was like, am I just trying to make this sound like a real trumpet, real horn section using these samples and all? Because the answer was always yes. I wasn't trying to make it sound like a synth horn section. I was trying to make it sound as much like the real things as possible. And I would just stop dead in my tracks and go hire a horn section. I only want to do what only I can do.
Yeah.
From here on out. From here on out, that's all I want to do is finish my songs. No one else is going to finish them. All this stuff I've collected over the years, and believe me, I'm very organized, and I've got so many titles at various stages of completion. And that's why all of these things, I'm constantly was asking myself that, you know, even when it's, you know, if I'm doing a Moog bass thing, even when it's in my, you know, what people would think would be my wheelhouse, if I knew a guy who did it better, I'm calling them up and saying, hey, would you do this for me? I don't want to be a watered down version of something else.
That sounds like a good plan. That sounds like a good way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know what I mean? I love, that's the thing is, you know, I've always had a home studio and I love just dicking around with all that stuff. And believe me, I could start messing with horn sounds and 3 days later, still messing around with horn sounds. And it's like all of a sudden, you know, cause in my head, I'm still 30 until I look in the mirror in the morning when I realize, you know what, the clock's ticking and it's time to get this stuff out.
Yeah.
Get moving. Finished.
So when you have a song on an album like Thriller, a song you wrote, Human Nature, you wrote that with John Bettis. When you have a song on an album that is so massively consumed, like Thriller, how much mailbox money is that really? Like, if you never did another thing, would you be okay just from that song?
Sure.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought. I mean, that's what I thought. That's how I hope the music industry worked back in the day. I don't know what it's like now. Totally sure, different.
But there's a lot of things, you know, again, that depends on the individual. You know, that means there's a lot of ways to go wrong. There's a lot of business things, you know, people, you know what I mean? Sell their publishing before they should. And
right.
That, you know what I mean? That cuts it in half right there. There's a lot of places you can go wrong. You know, some people acquire bad habits along the way and there's a lot of places to go wrong, but the short answer is yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. I mean, I didn't want to figure anything. I'm just wanted, I'm like, whenever I see someone has a credit on a massive album, I'm like, this has got, hopefully this, that's what I want. Hopefully this is good in the long run.
It's been very, very good to me. Excellent. And it's been probably, dare I say, more than any other song from Thriller. It's been covered more often, you know, what I mean? By other people. Miles Davis. I mean, that was, talk about, you know what I mean? My father, I think, was more thrilled that Miles Davis did a song of mine than me having something on Thriller. That was a very proud moment, and it's been and continues to be very good to me.
And was that a song that you had ever presented to the band?
Yes, the band did hear it. The band heard it in its demo state, the same way Quincy heard it.
Looking out across the nighttime, the city winks a sleepless eye. My window, sweet seducing sigh, get me out to the nighttime. Four walls won't hold me tonight. If this town is just an apple, then let me take.
You know, here was the thing is that I was so lucky in Toto where that even from the very beginning where Lukather and I were very much the junior members of the band. It was my brother, Jeff, and David Page.
And you're both Steve's.
Yes.
You're the youngest.
They really had the clout. And David Page was this major songwriting force. And, but from day one, we were always encouraged to write and they would cut and they wound up. I mean, listen to my song Secret Love on the second Toto album. It's this crazy experiment that they let me do. They would let me do anything. Studio time was a lot of money. Tape was very expensive, and they let me do anything I wanted to do. I was very lucky that way. So when it came to Human Nature, they didn't say no, but they did say when they first heard it, the first time the guys heard it, they were like, Steve, you know, Toto was getting this reputation as being this soft rock band.
Right.
Record company kept releasing the ballads.
Yeah.
Where we would have these major rockers on the record. Yeah. We were all excited about, but they kept putting out these ballads and these mid-tempo ballads. So, you know, the comment from the guys was, you know, for the next album, we're hoping to do more kind of stadium rock. So yeah. I just kept doing what I was doing.
Okay. So they were okay that you gave that song to Michael Jackson.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Quincy wasn't even looking for it. They had their mid-tempo ballad, that yeah. song Carousel. You know what I mean? Written by, you know what I mean? The great Mr. Michael Cimbello. You know what I mean? They were looking for the song that wound up being Beat It. They were looking, you know, the direction to Dave that Quincy was giving to David Page as far as writing songs goes, that he wanted another like My Sharona was what he was telling Page. So Human Nature couldn't have been further from my Sharona. You know what I mean? So I just kept working on this tune of mine. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm glad it worked out.
Oh boy, did it work out.
Oh yes. As a songwriter, what do you think now when you see a song that has like 10 or more writers on it? I mean, when I see that, I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. Most of them are like most guys my generation. You kind of roll your eyes and go, you know, but look at, it's a different time. First of all, you know, back in the day, we were expected to bring, look at Lukather's guitar part on Human Nature, how incredible that was that I had. And Quincy pretty much did my demo, except that guitar part. That wasn't a demo. That was Quincy and Steve Lukather when I was nowhere near around.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And when I first heard it, I was like, what? I didn't like it when I first heard it because it was different than my demo. But I realized very soon afterwards, it's what made it a Michael song. It's what gave it this R&B thing. You know, it made it a Michael Jackson song. Look at this guitar part. It was brilliant. Do you know how many times back in the day, us as studio musicians, what you brought to the table arrangement wise?
Yeah.
Some of these guys would just have their four chords or whatever, this demo. They're like, I don't know, what should we do for an intro? What should we do? You know, arrangement wise, I would see the guys all the time. You know, we'll do this and we'll make this a bridge and we'll do this solo section. No one got any writing credit. That was what was expected of you as a studio musician. And as a matter of fact, if you went up to Quincy and said, hey, how about some, you know, little writing? How about some publishing love on this? I did all this. You might not get hired again.
Yeah. So you don't want to jeopardize your
sweet
gig.
It was expected of you. And I'm saying that the last generation of, you know, the Hal Blaines and Carol Kays, all the stuff that they brought to the arrangements, it was expected of us. Where now it seems that, like, first of all, if you played on the song, if you played on the Beyonce song, if you played a guitar part or you actually played a bass part or whatever, you're a writer on the song.
Okay.
And you know what I mean? But you got to also remember, I'm sorry if I'm jumping around here.
No, you're fine. I'm jumping around with the questions too. So it's cool.
A lot of these songs, they start off writing to a drum beat that some guy in a production company did this drum groove. And you know what? So here's a guy who did not write one melody, one chord change, didn't write one word of lyric, and the song wouldn't exist without him.
Yep.
Sure, he's a writer on the song. You know what I'm saying? But it's a different world as well.
Well, I mean, I'm going back to this Cars book again. Rick Ocasek, he's listed as writing all the songs, but all the band members said the demos were skeletal at best, and everything the band members did made it that Cars sound and that Cars song, and they never got the publishing or anything or any credit. And that's a bummer.
It is. It was kind of true with Toto too, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us brought a lot to the table on songs like Africa and Rosanna and whatever. I used to kill myself on that stuff. You know what I mean? But I was just, you know what I mean? It wasn't, I wasn't worried about that. I wasn't going to say, well, I'm going to hold back because I'm not a writer on this song. You know what I mean? They were such great songs. I loved being part of it. And I loved, it was my band. And it was, you know, I loved differentiating between Toto and all the sessions I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I would do on a 3-hour David Foster session. I wanted there to be a distinction there with the Rosanna solo. Like, this is what I do when I have a week. to work out the, you know, when I'm respected like an arranger, you know, gets time to write out the string parts and, you know, just to get that kind of respect, which when you're doing synth sessions, it was like, come on, let's do a string part. You know what I mean? It'd be like, yeah, wait a minute. Can I, what are those changes? You know, it was
when I was when I was a teen and I would buy albums and I would read the credits and see the Toto guys on all these albums, I thought, oh, this is the sweetest gig. They get to go do their music, but then they get to be a part of all these different genres of other music and you know, and be involved and get credit and work with their heroes. And so, yeah, I think you guys are the sweet spot, I think, for all of that.
It's so very cool. Much so. And then even a lot of times guys that would do that, if you left town, if you weren't available when those producers called again, that was someone would take your gig and they might be their new go-to guy.
Yeah.
That happened all the time. But we were very lucky that there was quite a while there where we'd get home and we'd still get the calls, you know. By the way, the Cars, you know, Benjamin, the synth stuff he did was amazing. Elliot Easton, you know, what was the guy? Or on
Greg Hawks and yeah,
Greg Hawks on keyboards. Yes. Amazing.
Yeah. Talk really about cool synthesizers. Yeah.
Really, really cool. I was listening to all of that stuff, man. I was eating it up. You know what I mean? Those are great, great records. And I knew that those guys were bringing it to the table.
This is always a hard question to ask a songwriter, but is there one song throughout your entire career that brings you the most pride?
For me, it's easily Human Nature.
Okay. All right. Cool.
For me, it's easily Human Nature because it was, you know, it was just the Quincy accidentally heard the demo and it was me singing. Again, you know, I had the chorus, why tell him that it's human nature was there on the demo, but the rest was me singing some word salad, singing the same verse over and over again. I would have never turned it in to Quincy Jones in 100 million years. It was unfinished, but he got it. He got the whole thing was about the atmosphere, which is what was my thing as a songwriter. I loved feeling like you're in a place, you know what I mean? You're somewhere.
And I guess that's the genius of a guy like Quincy Jones. He hears something in that you didn't think was done or there yet.
You know, and like Lukather's guitar part, believe me, he didn't, you know what I mean? He listened to me a lot and he would do whatever the hell he wanted to do. You were just, because you were the songwriter, that didn't mean you were the arranger. That didn't mean you were the producer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You were just the songwriter. But to his credit, he totally let me reproduce my demo. He wanted that stuff down to the tape slap on the vocal. He wanted it just like my demo.
Nice. That's cool.
He knew what was meant. You know what I'm saying? He knew what was that sometimes when you redo, sometimes when you do things for real, you lose the magic of the demo of what attracted you to something in the first place. And he kind of, I was amazed at how much, quite honestly, you know, I was doing a lot of work with him anyway, but I was amazed at how much on Human Nature he let it be exactly my demo, you know, which a lot of the things weren't the usual, his norm, but he wanted that. He wanted that atmosphere and that vibe that he felt.
I joked earlier about you going back to college. This was your college, Steve.
Right.
Professor Jones.
Tell me about it.
I mean, this is working with all these, this was your school. I mean, one gets a better education than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Track 5, On the Very Day, Does It Really Matter? I love Shannon Forrest's drumming on this one. It's so great.
Thanks. Just
fantastic. Great Thanks. Song.
Thank you very much. That's one I'm really, really proud of. And I really like it a lot. And it's one of the very few that I'm the solo writer on it. And it was very much a prog thing. And look, that was me. There was a piece of software called Ableton Live. A lot of younger guys use it as far as their platform for a sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
That was me trying to learn it. I kept on, I would try to learn it and then I wouldn't think about it for a while. Then I'd try to teach it to myself. That was me, like a practice sequence, just trying to go to another track and try and teach myself this piece of software. And this thing came out that I was like, ooh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I finally finished it and Shannon played the hell out of the drums on it.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm going to jump to the last track, then I'm going to let you go. 11 songs on the very day. It's out now. Stream it. Then you're going to love it. And then first of the year, you're going to go buy it. So that's what we want you to do. Track 11 on this album, Saints and Angels, co-written with Stan Lynch and David Paich.
Yes.
Jason Scheff, formerly of Chicago, on lead vocals.
Singing, he said, come on, take a ride. I know just where to go. Left Ventura that day with its mission bell ringing, with the sounds of his home that was once Mexico.
What determines when you decide not to sing lead on one of your own songs on your own solo album?
You know, well, you know, a lot of songs come, sometimes they just kind of live in a certain key, you know, and again, I'm not trying to be the artist. I'm not going on the road. I'm not, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To me, it's about serving the songs.
Okay.
And this song just lived in the key that it lived in. Again, I'm looking at these albums as me as a songwriter.
Okay.
I mean, again, you say, you know, where was your college? I worked on 3 Quincy Jones solo albums, like The Dude, Back on the Block. I forgot the other one, but, you know, they were Quincy Jones solo albums.
Yeah.
But if you look at the writer credits, there's not one song written by Quincy Jones. The arranging credits, there's not one song arranged by Quincy Jones. Look at the playing credits. He didn't play anything on the album. And yet it's a Quincy Jones solo album.
Okay, I understand now. Okay.
Right? But who has final say about everything? Who's picking the arranger? Who would be the right guy for this? Who's the right guy to sing this? Let's call James Ingram up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's get Jerry Hay arranging this thing. Let's call Poco up to do some synths on this. Let's call Michael Boddicker to do synths on this one. Let's call it Paige to do some keyboard. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The best of the best.
You know, and what, but just your, he's got the final, you know what I'm saying? He's got the final say. He doesn't have to deal with an artist. So at the end of the day, I'm just trying to serve my songs. And quite often that means I'm not singing. And a guy like who sings like a bird, like Jeff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm lucky to get him. And we've been working a lot together and writing together and working on each other's stuff. So it's
very cool. And that's this song also has a fantastic rhythm section of Stan Lynch and Leland Sklar.
Yep. We brought in Stan to help with the lyrics. And I says, but so are you set up to play, to record at his house? And he has this amazing home studio, and you know what I'm saying, he's kept his chops way up and he sounded great.
Yeah, I've always loved Stan's drumming too, and I mean Leland Sklar's just the best. Now look, I don't want to get in, I don't like drama, but I'm gonna ask this question. On your previous solo album, Steve Lukather was on 4 tracks, but he's not on any of the tracks on this album. What's the status of your friendship with the other Steve?
You know, to me, it's you know, we haven't been real close lately. It's, I look at it like familial kind of stuff.
Okay.
No, we'll always be brothers. There was a bunch of legal crap to do with my brother's estates.
Okay.
And the ownership of the band name, stuff that had nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. But it's been a little chilly between us. I feel no, you know, I love the guy. I always loved him on my stuff because just the parts he would come up with, not only on Human Nature, but every Toto song, what he would do just sitting down after he would hear my songs would just be magical to me. I still love him. I just feel it's a familial thing that I'm hoping we get to the other side of at some point.
Well, I think you will. And just to add, just to make it about me for a second, Steve, I met you once. It was at the screening of that Terry Kath documentary.
Uh-huh, sure.
And you were, and Luke had been on my podcast twice, and I was with my friend, Mike, and I turned and I said to Mike, I go, there's Lukather's over there. And Luke turned and he recognized me, which I was not expecting him to do.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Hey, I know you." And he turned to you and he said, "I want you to meet my friend, Steve." And I just, when I think about you guys, I think about him saying, "I want you to meet my friend, Steve."
Sure.
So I'm just
sure
letting you know. And of course, in my head, I was like, yeah, I know who that other Steve is.
Yeah. No, and when I would been working with the band then, and when
yes,
I got back with the band, you know, look at it. It was supposed to be, he asked me to do one summer with them. This is 2020.
Yeah.
He said, come do one summer with us. Because I was doing a TV show at the time.
Yeah.
Justified. You know what I mean? I said, as long as you'll do it around my TV schedule, you know what I mean? And I was off all summer and it turned into 9 years. So, you know, obviously I was having a good time, you know.
One more thing. 2015, Toto releases the excellent Toto 14. Mm-hmm. You co-wrote a song and sing it called The Little Things, which I love. And you wrote it with Allie Willis.
When you can't find the pearls you once held in your hand, how can all these things keep changing so fast? You can't count on anything to last. I just don't know.
What was it like writing with Allie? Because she just seemed like the most fun person.
She was the best. I had been, this is even before I was working with Toto again, a dear friend, Greg Sill, who has really helped me with my film career and was helped me get some TV gigs and stuff. He knew Allie. He knew I was looking for lyricists. You know what I mean? I was wanting to finish my songs and was always looking for some lyrical help. And he goes, "You want to work with Allie Willis?" And I, you know, it's always a weird thing. You don't know what it's going to be like with someone, especially a legend like her. And it turns out she just lived a few blocks away from me. She loved that. She loved that. And we hit it off so good. We hit it off so great. It was such a fun experience. And, you know, that song, Little Thing, you know, I had an intro and I had the chords all laid out. And just to tell you a quick funny story, you know, I'm usually the music guy, and you would think Allie is the lyric person. We get together right here at my house and we're in the studio and we're writing. It's time to start writing some lyrics. And she was like, what do you want to, what do you feel like saying here? And I would say a line, I would say something like this. And she'd go, that's good. And she'd write it down. And she'd go, what should that go through? I go, maybe something like this. She goes, that's great. I wound up writing just about all the lyrics to the song. You know what I mean? 90% of the lyrics. And the melody was all her.
Yeah, she tricked you into writing lyrics.
Totally tricked me into writing lyrics. It was really funny. But that's part of the, right? That's the magic of working with someone like that is. And we wound up, believe me, the song was, there were a lot of moving parts and different sections. And she wound up really, she was such a pro. We wound up doing stuff at her house. But it was always fun. It was always a groove. It was always, she was the best. And I was so bummed out in the, within a 3-month period, I lost Michael Sherwood, you know, one of my main writing partners, and Allie both. And it just was like devastating. Yeah.
You don't have a website currently, Steve.
Yes, I do. StevePicaroMusic.com.
What? Okay. Well, look at that. Look at that mistake I end the interview on. Okay. StevePicaroMusic.com, Instagram at StevePicaroMusic, Facebook at StevePicaroMusic. You are branded. You are branded everywhere. The album is The Very Day. Physical copies after the first of the year. Listen to it right now. If you're listening to this right now, turn this off and go listen to The Very Day. And with that, Steve, last question. What do you want me to use as the playout song today? What song from the new album is going to take us out?
Ooh, let's go into the, Does It Really Matter?
Does It Really Matter? Okay, you got it. Steve, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And continued success with The Very Day.
Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
Thank you. Take care, Steve.
Bye-bye.
And Steve, give me the correct pronunciation of your last name.
Porcaro.
Porcaro. Okay. Okay. Now I'll do my intro and we'll be off and running.
Great.
Okay. Porcaro. I know I've been saying it wrong my whole life. So I don't want to say it wrong here.
I think people in my family have been saying it wrong.
I only really need to say it right one time, because then I'm just going to call you Steve.
Believe me, I've been called worse, whatever, however.
All right, let me give it a whirl. Here we go.